Hi. As the name of the podcast suggests, I connect a lot of topics together in the service of growing the practice of psychotherapy. As the number of episodes grows, it occurred to me that I could offer you a way to organize the episodes. So I've created playlists. Playlists are compilations of all the episodes on one topic. If you'd like to try this out, there is a link in the show notes to the playlist page, where you will find the categories, and then you click on the category you're interested in, and you'll see all the episodes on that topic. I hope you enjoy it. While you're there, you could sign up for the newsletter if you like. Those come out weekly and are a great way for us to stay in touch, and for you to keep up to date about the podcast and additional events. Hello, and thank you for joining the Connection Therapy Podcast. This is a podcast about the craft of psychotherapy, and we seek to support those who strive to improve their craft by sharing research about the science and stories about the art of psychology. Together, we will explore these findings so you can decide how you want to apply them to benefit your practice. In this episode, I'm going to put into practice some of the research articles I've been reviewing recently on the podcast. One of my focus areas for the podcast is to provide you with updated research and other factors that influence the practice of mental health. And I've been doing that lately in recent episodes, but haven't left much room for actually summarizing how they might be translated from the research article into clinical practice. That can be a difficult task sometimes, and it's probably best done in community when we talk through it with each other. So I'll open up some thoughts here for your consideration of how you might apply them to your practice by sharing how I work with these topics in the way I work. All right, let's start with going back to episode number 35. In that episode, there were a couple studies, and one was what's called a systematic study that reviewed a lot of previous research on what they termed interpersonal physiology, looking for things like physiological synchrony. And as much as I love these words, they're actually hard to remember and hard to say. So interpersonal physiology is their umbrella term for the many ways, many of which I think we will continue to learn about as technology catches up to the ability to measure and assess these things. But it's an umbrella term for the many ways that being with someone can have multiple avenues and channels for there to be communication back and forth between two beings. In earlier episodes, we established, and some of these studies they reviewed confirm this as well, that this does go across species and certainly obviously across humans in different contexts. But there's a way that our heart rate variability is in interaction with each other, our physical movements that we learned from Beatrice Beebe and Rebecca Houghton earlier in episodes. But this number 35 kind of summarized that into this idea of physiological synchrony that happens interpersonally, so between two beings, and physiologically. So what is happening in the body can be measured, and despite maybe first glance, there's lots of ways that when we are with someone or near someone, our own systems start to interact with theirs, sometimes in directions that go toward a positive valence or like a positive emotion, sometimes that go toward a negative emotion. And the point there, though, is that we are constantly in interaction with each other. And so this is, I think, a really remarkable statement because the implications for clinical practice are so wide-ranging, it can be a little overwhelming at first to consider that the way we speak, the way we look at someone, the way we sit, in episode number 36, the way we smell, and the way we can smell them, also has impacts for our experience of being with them. And I think for mental health therapists, the real implication here is it has impacts on your patients for what it's like to be with you. And I'll speak for myself, you know, I work really hard to kind of take the focus off myself in session and really place the focus on my patients. And so this awareness of how many ways that I could be impacting session by my own physiology is humbling, to say the least. You know, it's quite counterintuitive based on how we're trained. Typically, we're trained to, you know, all of our interventions are about the other person. With few exceptions, most therapy practices encourage us to not talk about ourselves. There are some actual specific therapy practices that do encourage the therapist self-disclosure, but I don't practice in that way. And I think the majority of modalities encourage less or no self-disclosure. So there's this way that you can kind of get into practicing and thinking that you're not in the room, you know, so to speak. You're just there to observe and help the other person. And certainly the early psychoanalytic traditions had that orientation. And to realize that whether we want to or not, we are impacting things. And so in terms of how I use that and how I practice, the first thing is just to be aware of that and to notice what it does for me to realize how much I am impacting someone, whether I am aware of that or not. That has a way that, you know, it evokes a lot of emotions in me to consider that if I'm having a bad day, I might put off a nonverbal signal that my patient would be able to pick up on. And what do I do with that? Do I just pretend like it's not there? Well, that's counterintuitive typically to most of my therapy goals for people, because if I'm encouraging them to be genuine and authentic as a mode of having better relationships, which is usually something that a lot of people come to therapy for support in doing. And so now we have this situation where I am in a bit of a bind clinically because I'm asking someone to be genuine when they feel an emotion that, you know, I can perhaps sense through the physiological synchrony, maybe a tightening in my chest, or I just, you know, listen to the tone of their voice or watch their eyes. And if they pick up the same in me and I don't endorse it, even if it's accurate, now I'm in a real bind because that isn't genuine. And yet at the same time, the session is about them. So I don't want to then further disclose. So typically what I do, especially this happens a lot with teenagers, I find in that age range, humans are really adept at figuring out someone else's states of like their nervous system. I don't know what happens after that. I think maybe social conditioning takes over and we don't say it as much as adults. But in the teenagers, people are pretty curious, you know, rightfully so. And so I typically do endorse if someone's accurate and then try to return the focus back to them. And hopefully by that point in our therapeutic rapport, they're used to me focusing on them. And so it's a fairly easy switch back. So that's one way that I have incorporated this awareness into my way that I work, is to, you know, go ahead and acknowledge if someone is accurate in picking up a nervous state system in me, even if it's one that I sort of wish weren't true that day, if you will, but then just return the focus back to them as quickly as possible. The next episode I just highlighted was 36, and that's the scent episode, where it's very clear that horses, dogs, and even other humans can detect scent. And what really struck me with that episode and continues to hold my attention is the fact that, you know, they didn't really ask, of course, we can't ask the horses, well, Do you feel the same way as the human sent in the vials that they were presented with? This is the episode where there were two different studies and they kind of captured some human sense when the humans were experiencing different emotions. They put them near dogs or near horses, and then the animals displayed similar behaviors that happen when they were in similar nervous system states. And so this I find just so fascinating because it's really an important implication for therapy, because we really don't need to know the name or the term for the, you know, we don't need to know what we're feeling for our nervous system state to start synchronizing with the being in front of us. And that, I think, has tremendous clinical implications that we're only starting to really think about. Because if I can, you know, walk into a room, therapy room or restaurant or airport or anything else, and start to pick up the nervous system states of those around me through all of these different ways that we've talked about so far, and then my own nervous system kind of responds in a similar way, I find that very important because now we're talking about I may be actually feeling differently, like maybe I was, you know, having a good day or something, and now I'm my body is responding to my environment, and all of a sudden my system, my physical system, is starting to display the things that happen when I'm in a different nervous system state. And for those of us who work with children therapeutically, I think this is really important, because what it says is that, you know, the child can maybe be feeling or thinking something, but their environment that they are in is profoundly influencing the way that they might be behaving. And there's probably a lot more to say there, but at the moment, I just kind of really observe and consider that possibility, because again, the last few episodes have just opened up an entire world of possibility that I think we need to consider from a therapy perspective. So for this one, I'm just sort of still humbled and you know, worried about smells in my office more than I otherwise would be. But it does really kind of on the back burner of my mind make me think about the vast implications of those couple of research studies in episode number 36. 37, of course, was about essentially a reminder to keep trying. This is the review of the work by Beebe and Lachman that summarized a lot of things we know about human development and how they affect relationships all throughout the lifespan. But my summary kind of takeaway and how I work clinically with their work, how I incorporate their work into my work, is to just keep trying. So much of their work and findings have strengthened the original concept from Winnicott that what really matters is a good enough relationship. And what I find from a therapy perspective as a practicing clinician is that it's the effort that people notice and the consistency, like their work also highlighted, that, you know, even if we make mistakes, and I make mistakes a lot, we have a genuine intent and a kind of earnestness about us, then people really respond to that. I learned that early in my training, when I was becoming a psychologist, as an intern, you make even more mistakes than I make now. And what I was encouraged to do by my supervisors, and what remains something that works well to build relationships, is just to admit it when I make a mistake and just, you know, call myself out, apologize, and, you know, move on. And I feel like this is such an under-experienced phenomena for someone to admit a mistake, apologize, and then move on, that our therapy patients just really appreciate that. And it goes a long way to building that therapeutic rapport and trust. And, you know, in case you aren't confident that that would work, it also has the benefit of modeling the behaviors that most patients might have on their treatment plan. And that, again, you know, increasing their social relationship skills so they can see how it's done with a trusted adult and then maybe experiment with that for themselves. But my own experience is it becomes a really kind of special condition when it happens that neither party forgets usually. And there's a way that it kind of locks in the relationship a little bit stronger. In 38, I talked about the alignment between what people say and what we see them exhibiting in nonverbal signals. And what I was highlighting there is what is so common, and that is a very normal experience. Usually when people come to therapy, they very often want things to be different than they are in their life. And what is so counterintuitive is that usually, in my observation and experience, the thing that makes things change, which seems so unlikely that it would have an impact, is to admit however they are in that moment, you know, to finally get to that point where you stop trying to change them and you just sort of admit, like, if someone is sad and they want to be happy, then they can at some point just have a moment where it's okay, at least for that little moment, to be sad. And it's this really interesting phenomena where it's like once we kind of admit how we actually feel or what's actually happening, that, in my experience, is kind of one of the changes that, or one of the moments that then enables the change that they're seeking. And so that's how I work with the things we learned in 38 about aligning nonverbal signals with verbal statements, is to see and observe and make comments on those inconsistencies in a gentle way, not to sort of call people out or anything like that, but just sort of continually notice, keeping the bond strong, like we learned in the previous episode from Beebe and Lachman, you know, doing all those things that keep a consistent relationship happening therapeutically, something becomes trustworthy enough such that then when the difference between how someone displays how they're feeling nonverbally and what they say, if I continually kind of observe and gently comment on those things, they themselves start to see the inconsistencies, and there's like a confidence that becomes theirs when they can now observe themselves and feel like they're in a little bit more awareness of their own states and sort of maybe a little bit more able to influence things in their world, that gives them a lot of momentum that usually does eventually maybe lead to the change they would like to see. In 39, we talked about this mimicking research, and that one is also interesting. I put that in the list of things to research because I feel like it's an important reminder for us that in therapy and in all relationships, that mimicking is a social skill. So this research talked about they've seen mimicking in different studies all throughout the lifespan, as early as this study included with 18-month-old children. And what happened was the children who were mimicked by the researcher actually displayed pro-social behaviors toward the researcher afterwards, and even toward other adults. And we need mimicking as children. That was earlier in the podcast. We've talked about the mirror stage from Lacan and others that I reviewed when I reviewed my own research in episodes 2, 3, and 4. Mimicking is important because it has some strong social implications. We've got to learn to live in community, and mimicking it appears to be one of those behaviors that helps us do that. But what I also think is really important as mental health clinicians is to consider that that is a layer of social relationships that can mask what we need to be working on in therapy. And it's related to something that I didn't bring up in that episode, but that I've had experience with in the past. Before I became a psychologist, I was on different teams where I was interviewing job applicants for the companies where I worked. And I was taught multiple times by multiple human resources departments to become aware of the fact that it's very common in job interviews for mimicking to happen. And it's along the way, I'm sure you will actually might have an experience of this if I describe an example. So say let's just take this example. You're doing an interview for a job applicant. You're on the hiring team. So you're one of the people asking questions. And it's really common to start with something, you know, sort of generic, because job interviews are very awkward and formulaic, that people often start off by saying, you know, where they live, where they did their schooling, where they have grown up, other things when they're introducing themselves. And it's a very natural thing for the interviewers to interject something that they have in common, like, oh, you know what? Me too. I didn't realize you're from Colorado. I am too. Where did you grow up? And this kind of takes the interview in a totally different trajectory, where now all of a sudden we're talking about favorite coffee shops and favorite restaurants in Colorado and nothing about the job duties that this person is interviewing for in that moment. And we received a lot of training from our HR professionals to not do that, because it can mean that someone gets hired because they have things in common, or because the interview went in a mimicking direction where we're all sort of doing that social skill and not actually checking to see if the qualifications for the job were met before we hired this person. They just had a good interview, so they sort of went on to the next round and then, you know, may end up getting hired. So that's what this mimicking research reminds me of. There's a way that this is so built in to social interactions that it can kind of be a layer on top of the real information that needs to be discussed and considered. And so for myself now, as a psychologist, I really think a lot about mimicking behaviors. I notice them, and I do, especially, like I say, a lot of times social relationships are what we're working on in therapy and the skills that build them. So I don't want to not have mimicking happen, because for someone who's building those skills of social relationships, I know it's part of that skill set. But when I find that they're happening and the person's kind of getting them and they are able to do that in a socially responsible way, then I actually consciously want to tamp that down at times to ensure that I'm really listening and hearing what the conversation needs to focus on and staying there as much as possible. And so that brings me to kind of the conclusion here of the last few episodes and wanting to draw home all the ways that these different research articles that I've presented have implications for our therapeutic work. Because the summary line of all of these things, and in fact, even beyond just the last few episodes, but many of the episodes, what we are talking about in terms of what this research is telling us is, to me, the power of two things. And that is, first, seeing what we see. You know, really allowing ourselves to observe what we see. And the second is related to that, and that is letting ourselves see it. So I want to kind of break that down and tell you how I mean it. It's sort of like, I want the best for all of my patients. And yet I can't want that so badly that it kind of fogs my view of where things are actually at for them. Even though I want the best for them, it today may not be, or this part or moment in their life may not be the best moment. And I have to be able to take all of this ways, all of these ways that the many channels of communication are helping me understand where they are at in that moment or in our work together currently. And I have to filter all of those things so I can really see what it is that's in front of me in terms of how this person is functioning at that moment. And that's the second thing, is as much as I might want it to be different from what I see, I need to let myself see that. So it's like this, to me, it's kind of a twofold thing where you have to have the ability to really be a strong observer. And by that, I like to include and continue learning about the many ways I can see my patients. And that's why I'm presenting all these research episodes for you, so that you could do the same if you so choose. And then the second one is this sort of like internal relationship with myself, where I have to be okay with things, not be okay with them, but I have to be honest about things when I see them functioning in ways that I hope were different. And that's where the trust episodes that Kinsey and I talked about in our interviews in episodes 26, 27, and 28. That's where that trust really comes in for me, is if I can slow down myself and increase my ability for observation, then I can really start to make subtle interventions that don't need to be these sort of overt things, but can be co-created in the moment with the patient. Because I feel like when I'm able to calm myself down enough and not within myself have that tension of where I can't really see how things are going because I wish so badly for them to be different for the person, but I just sort of relax into the fact that this is where we are right now today, and it's hard. And then it becomes a co-created process, because it's like, it's difficult and I trust that we're going to make it through this. And I explained a lot more about that when Kinsey and I had our conversation, because it takes a lot to be able to wait and not sort of rush things when they aren't in a state that you want them to be. But my experience is that that co-creation and that co-ability to be in the moment together, whatever it is what enhances the ability for the therapeutic process to kind of quicken a little bit. And that's how I take all of these episodes, is to consider both of those things, where I now know many more ways that I can see the sort of communication channels verbally, non-verbally, and even through scent. That one still bugs me. That one's going to bug me for a while, actually. But nevertheless, I try to incorporate this into my awareness and, you know, just sort of calmly continue with the therapy practice with the confidence and the trust that the person and I can find a way through it that is best for them. And that's how I like to work and can continually increase my knowledge while also increasing my humility of the so many things that I cannot change and can't influence, that even within those dynamics, we're going to find some way through it that improves things at least somewhat, at least a little bit for the person. I know that doesn't sound very inspiring, that it's at least a little bit, but what I found that is healing is something that my supervisor told me a long time ago. I've mentioned it once before on the podcast, and that is that people don't really come to therapy to be told how to do things, but they come to therapy to have company when they go through the hard things. And that sustains how I have an orientation of what is healing and how therapy can be beneficial, despite the many things that we now know are influencing our sessions. Thanks so much. I hope you'll join us again for future explorations in the field of psychology. And if you'd like to take a step further, there are additional ways to obtain more education and support on our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com. While there, you will find information about the authors and studies featured in the podcast episodes. Also, you will see a schedule of live trainings I offer on the topics featured in the podcast. And you will find information about the Connection Community, a growing group of mental health clinicians dedicated to the study and practice of psychotherapy. Please check out our website, connectiontherapypodcast.com, to learn more. Thanks. Until next time.